Fenring carried several knives tucked into his coveralls, and he certainly knew how to use them. A simple division of responsibilities, Zoal set a brisk pace, with Fenring hurrying to keep up. The shapeshifter confidently made his way along dim, low-ceilinged corridors. "The blueprints show that the navigator's chamber is this way. Follow me, and we will be done before long." They had studied Highliner blueprint hollows left behind in the subterranean assembly facilities on Ix, where the ships had originally been built. Since this giant vessel would not be ready to depart for several more weeks, no navigator occupied the tank, and the spice supply had not yet been replenished. Security would not be at its tightest yet. "Around this corner," Zoal kept his uninflected voice low. He took out a Redulian handboard and fingered through sheets of shimmering crystal, illuminating a rough diagram of the Highliner's upper levels. As they approached a guard stationed at the far end of the corridor, Zoal put on a deeply puzzled expression and pointed to lines on the handboard. Fenring shook his head, feigning disagreement. They walked toward the guard, who stood stiffly at attention, his stunner at his hip. Fenring raised his annoyed voice as they drew closer. "This is not the right level, I tell you. We're in the wrong section of the Highliner. Look here." He jabbed his fingers at the crystal sheets. Playing his part like a jongleur, Zoal flushed. "Listen to me. We followed the direction step by step." He glanced up, pretending to notice the guard for the first time. "Let's ask him." He pushed forward, closing the distance. Glowering, the guard jerked a thumb toward Fenring. "You're both in the wrong section. No unauthorized access." With a sigh of disgust, Zoal held up the Highliner drawing on his handboard, pushing it toward the guard's face. "Well, then, can you direct us?" Fenring pressed close on the other side. The guard peered at the crystal board. "Here's your problem. This isn't..." With flawless grace, Fenring slipped his long, slim knife through the man's ribs and deep into his liver, then twisted the blade and pushed higher into the lungs. He avoided major blood vessels to minimize bleeding, but the wound was sufficiently fatal. The guard gasped and twitched. Dropping his handboard, Zoal grabbed the victim in a brutally strong grip. Fenring withdrew his slender knife and stabbed again, this time under the sternum and up into the heart. Zoal stared into the guard's face as he eased the slumping body to the deck. Then the face dancer twitched. His features became liquid, as if made of soft clay, and shifted into a new mask. His appearance was now identical to the guard's. Zoal drew a deep breath, twitched his head to one side, then stared at the dead man's face. "I am finished." They dragged the corpse into an unoccupied closet and sealed the door. Fenring waited while the face dancer changed clothes with the murdered guard, applying enzyme sponges to dissolve the worst of the bloodstains. Afterward, they used the Redulian handboard to consult an accurate schematic of the upper Highliner levels and located a disposal chute that dropped into the heated reactor chamber. The guard's ionized ashes would never be found. Together, they proceeded into the security area. The Count carried his toolkit, and this time feigned a look of aggrieved distress, as if he had been given an impossible work assignment. The imposter marched him along, gruffly acknowledging other guards on the higher levels. They succeeded in finding an unoccupied operations chamber behind the navigator's tank. The spice compartment was, as expected, empty. Quickly, Fenring removed the canisters of super-compressed Amal pellets, dense tablets of synthetic spice shaped exactly like their melange counterparts. In such a potent form, the spice would be vaporized to create a rich gas, thick enough that a navigator could feel its full effects and envision safe paths through fold space. Fenring sealed the container into the spice supply compartment, then applied a counterfeit approval label. It might cause some confusion when the spice stalkers found the chamber already loaded, but they would not think too hard upon finding an excess of melange. With luck, no one would complain. The conspirators slipped back out. Within an hour, they had departed from the Highliner yards and moved to the next stage of their plan. "I hope the vessel in orbit will be just as easy to break into, Fenring said. "We need 2 test ships to be absolutely sure." The face dancer looked at him. Zoal's ability to mimic the guard's features was eerie. "It may take a bit more finesse, but we'll get in." Afterward, weary but exhilarated from completing the second half of their mission, they stood under the cloudy skies and twinkling lights of the junction spaceport. They hid among piled dump boxes at the edge of the loading zone. Fenring wanted to avoid conversation with guild workers who might ask too many questions. He could easily have hired a mercenary or a professional commando to complete this covert mission, but Fenring liked to perform dirty work himself when it interested him. This kept his abilities honed and provided him with pleasure. During a moment of guarded peace, the Count soothed himself with thoughts of his lovely wife, Margaret. He was anxious to return to the Imperial Palace, where he would see and learn what she'd been up to. She should have arrived on Kytane several days ago. Zoal interrupted his reverie. "Count Fenring, I must compliment you on your skills. You have done your part well." "A compliment from a face dancer, Pretending to relax, Fenring leaned against a corroded metal dump box that would soon be hauled up to a Highliner. "Thank you." Seeing a blur, he instinctively jerked to one side just as a flash came toward him, a knife thrown with deadly accuracy. Even before the point of his first weapon missed its target and clanged against the metal cubicle, the face dancer snatched another blade hidden in his uniform. But Count Hasimir Fenring was more than equal to the challenge. His senses and reactions tuned to an extremely high level, he drew his own knives and dropped into a fighting stance, his expression feral. "Ah, I thought you were supposed to be untrained in blade work." The face dancer wore a hard, predatory expression. "I have also been trained to lie, but apparently not well enough." Fenring held his knife. He had more experience in assassin's work than this shapeshifter could ever imagine. "The Tleilaxu have underestimated me. Another mistake." In the dim light of the spaceport, Zoal's features flickered and shifted once more. His shoulders became broader, his face narrow, his eyes overlarge, until Fenring was looking into a nightmarish reflection of himself, but in the face dancer's clothing. "Soon I will play a new role as Imperial Spice Minister and boyhood friend of Shaddam the Fourth." The entire plot fell into place for Fenring. How this Tleilaxu creature would mimic him, passing himself off as a confidant of the Emperor's. Although Fenring doubted Zoal could fool Shaddam for long, the shapeshifter needed only to get close to the Emperor for a few moments in private, where he could kill him and then take over the Golden Lion throne, as ordered by Ajitika. Fenring admired the audacity. Considering the botched decisions Shaddam had made of late, perhaps this simulacrum might not be an altogether unwelcome alternative. "Never fool my Bene Gesserit wife. Margaret notices the subtlest details." Zoal smiled, an uncharacteristic usage of Fenring's ferret-like facial features. "I believe I am up to the challenge now that I have observed you closely." The face dancer lunged, and Fenring parried with one of his own knives. Their daggers clashed again, and the combatants used their bodies as weapons, slamming each other against the dump boxes. His back against the wall, Fenring kicked out, trying to break Zoal's shin. But the changeling dodged and brought his blade point up in a flash. Fenring swung his right forearm, deflected the knife from his eye, then rolled away from the dump boxes. Sweat poured from both fighters. Zoal had a nick under his chin, which dripped scarlet. The Count's coveralls had been slashed in several places, yet the shapeshifter had not succeeded in injuring him, not even a scratch. Still, Fenring very nearly underestimated the Face Dancer, who elevated his abilities and fought with renewed frenzy. His knife attacks became a blur. This was a danger Fenring had not contemplated. The shapeshifter was mimicking the Count's formidable fighting skills, learning from him, stealing tricks. The Count considered what to do and when to do it, never letting his guard down. He needed to come up with a new move, one this laboratory-bred creature would never expect. He thought of trying to capture the shapeshifter alive in order to interrogate him, but that would be too risky. He couldn't let their mission here be exposed. He heard the whine of a shuttle in the background, but didn't dare look. The smallest lapse would be fatal. Fenring let himself stumble and fall backward, pulling the shapeshifter down with him. The Count self-consciously grunted as if in pain and dropped his own knife. It clanged and skittered out of reach under one of the dump boxes. Thinking he had wounded his quarry, the kneeling Zoal raised his blade, prepared to deliver the killing blow. But Fenring had surveyed the ground first and landed near the place where the Face Dancer's first thrown knife had fallen. In a single fluid movement, he snatched up the forgotten dagger before Zoal could bring down his own weapon. Fenring plunged the tip into the Face Dancer's throat. He kicked Zoal away from him before the shapeshifter's severed jugular could spray blood all over his clean clothes. The Face Dancer's body sprawled in the shadows between dump boxes. Fenring backed away, looking around to make certain no one had seen or heard anything. He did not want to answer questions. He just needed to be far from here. Slumped on the ground, Zoal seemed to melt, his features losing precise focus, until he had transformed into a hairless, smooth-faced mannequin with no distinctive qualities. Waxy skin and smooth fingers without the whirl of fingerprints. This Tleilaxu plot was particularly intriguing. Fenring would hoard that knowledge as if it were a prized treasure. He would consider how best to use it against Hydar Phenagidica. Breathing hard, but still breathing, Fenring stuffed the Face Dancer's body into one of the dump boxes and sealed the hatches. Within weeks, the bizarre cadaver would arrive on some distant world, much to the surprise of the cargo's intended recipient. Fenring glanced toward the spaceport lights and saw that the orbital shuttle was just setting down. He would take a roundabout passage back to Kaitain, leaving no traceable path. Of secondary concern, he needed to avoid traveling on either of the two Dominic-class highliners, just in case the navigators had unfortunate reactions to synthetic spice. Fenring did not intend to be part of the test himself. Exhilarated, he hurried to the spaceport and joined a crowd of workers and third-class passengers boarding the shuttle. As he rode the shuttle toward the highliner that orbited Junction, he kept to himself and answered no questions, though two of his fellow passengers asked him why he wore such a rich smile on his face. A secret is most valuable when it remains a secret. Under such circumstances, one does not require proof in order to exploit the information. Bene Gesserit dictum. Shortly after arriving on Kaitain, as ordered by the Baron, Peter de Vries padded through the corridors of the Imperial Office complex. His Mentat mind easily kept track of every turn in the maze of connected government buildings. It was mid-morning, and he still tasted the sweetness of imported fruit in his mouth from breakfast on board the diplomatic frigate. More delicious, though, was the incriminating knowledge that he had been instructed to deliver anonymously. Shaddam would probably soil his imperial trousers when he learned of it. He brought out a message cube from beneath his clothing and concealed it in a wall alcove behind an idealized bust of the emperor, one of many scattered throughout the palace. A side door in the office complex opened, and a ruddy-faced, intense man stepped into the corridor. De Vries recognized the Harkonnen ambassador, Kallo Wills. In his mid-30s, Wills looked barely old enough to shave. He had obtained his position through family connections. None of the information Wills sent back to Gedi Prime ever proved to be of any value. He was ineffective, unschooled in how to use his position to become a competent spy.
"I, Peter de Vries," Wills hailed in a syrupy voice. "I didn't know you were in the palace. The Baron sent me no notification. Are you coming to make a courtesy call?"
The Mentat feigned surprise.
"Perhaps soon, Mr. Ambassador, but at the moment I have an important appointment. Business for the Baron."
"Yes, time is short, isn't it?" Wills agreed with a broad smile. "Well, I must hurry off, too. We both have so many vital things to do. Let me know later if I can help in any way."
The ambassador bustled down the corridor in the opposite direction, obviously trying to look important. Up a Vinstroy paper, the Mentat sketched a map and wrote directions, to be given to an imperial courier, who would pick up this hidden message cube and take it directly to Shaddam. A bombshell. This would be a suitable revenge for the Rachesian blackmail. It must work. Aloha Rund supervised while laboratory metal workers completed the casing of a prototype invisibility generator, based upon sketches and equations the renegade inventor Chobin had left behind. In one of his sealed shigawire spools, Chobin had called this a no-field, making an object both here and not here at the same time. During every waking moment, Rund thought about the amazing concept. He still had not deciphered the intermittently failing invisibility mechanism in the rogue inventor's old laboratory chamber. Judging from fragments of schematics, he had determined that the minimum diameter for projecting the no-field was 150 meters. With this in mind, Run didn't see how the device could disguise a small laboratory room, until he discovered that most of the field extended asymmetrically outside the Corona station into space. Upon hearing of the project, and after complete funding had been supplied by the Rachesian government, Count Ilben Rachese had sent a message to his nephew, congratulating him for his ingenuity and foresight. The old man promised someday to come up to Corona, where he might see the work firsthand, though he doubted he would understand it. Premier Kalamar sent his own supportive communication, encouraging the inventors. For decades, this artificial moon had concealed the proprietary technology for manufacturing mysterious and valuable Rachesian mirrors. No other house had been able to duplicate the science of the mirrors, despite numerous attempts at industrial espionage. If a no-field breakthrough occurred, though, Corona's facilities might begin to produce an even more valuable technology. The all-out research and development effort was extremely expensive and required the brain power of the best scientists, diverting them from other duties. Recently, Premier Kalamar had delivered full funding in the form of a large melange stockpile that would be stored on the satellite station, where it could be liquidated for cash as necessary.
Malign storage vaults now accounted for 6% of Corona's usable volume. The political clout of Director Flint O'Kinnis had increased because of the ambitious project, but Halloa Rund didn't care. Chobin's generator was an exceedingly complex problem, enough to demand his complete attention. The inventor worried about nothing else. When Shaddam opened the message cube, he canceled all further appointments and locked himself in his private study, fuming. An hour later, he summoned Supreme Bashar Zoom-Garon. "It seems that my Sardaukar have more work to do." He could barely suppress his rage. The old veteran, Garon, resplendent in his uniform, stood at attention, listening for further orders. "We are at your command, sire." After all the express warnings and after the severe example Shaddam had set on Zanovar, House Richiz had the temerity to do this. Premier Kalamar believed he could just ignore an imperial decree and keep his own illegal melange stockpile. The surreptitious message provided incontrovertible proof that an illegal quantity of spice was stored inside the artificial moon of Corona. At first he had been suspicious of similar claims. Ekars and Grumman had done their best to cast suspicion on each other, pointing fingers, exaggerating accusations. But their proof had been flimsy, their motives transparent. "It is time to set another example, to show the citizens of the Imperium that they cannot ignore Carino laws." Shaddam paced the floor. As his anger simmered, the Emperor's better sense came into play. The core motivation behind his first attack on Zanovar had been to erase Tyros Repha. However, his larger scheme was to leave the imperial economy completely vulnerable to his impending monopoly on synthetic spice. He had to take the next step, increase the stakes. Richiz would be the second scapegoat. He would notify guild investigators and Choam auditors of his upcoming measure. After the alleged stockpile was removed from Corona and used as a payoff to buy guild and Choam support, other political factions would gather behind the throne as well. Since Hazimir Fenring had not yet returned from Ix, Shaddam would have to make another important decision by himself. No matter. The Emperor knew what to do, and the response could not wait. He gave the Sardaukar commander his orders. The great spice war was about to heat up. It has been demonstrated in every epoch of history that if you want profits, you must rule. And to rule, you must blunt the edge of the citizenry. Emperor Shaddam Carino IV. Flushed with the Agitimal pulsing through his thoughts, Haidar Fenagitica had a lizard's eye view of the corpses in the dining hall. 22 of the most meddlesome Tleilaxu masters lay slumped over the tables, poisoned. Dead. Fired by the revelations he had received from God, he was about to redraw the lines of power in the Imperium. And among the bodies, a bonus. The pretentious Master Zaf himself, who had arrived the day before on an unexpected inspection tour. With piquant slig stew spilled all over himself, Zaf lay supine, his eyes bulging and mouth open, a most undistinguished state of death for the Master of Masters. The fast-acting toxin slipped into the food by face-dancer cooks had sent Zaf and his dinner companions into paroxysms within minutes, and their gray skin had turned a sickly scarlet, as if scalded from the inside out. When the master researcher stood in the doorway, admiring his accomplishment, he had noticed a Draco Volans in the rafters, one of the little lizards that seemed immune to pest control measures. Only a few centimeters long, it had scaly appendages on either side of its body that permitted it to glide through the air like a Terran flying squirrel. seeing the lizard, Ajitika had decided to exercise the sparkling new powers that had come to him after consuming so much Ajitamal. Now his mind's eye seemed to be inside the diminutive dragon. From a perch in the rafters, he gazed down on the results of the slaughter through reptilian eyes. One of the bodies twitched, then fell as still as the rest. Nearly 2 dozen dead masters. It was a good start, as far as he was concerned. The Tleilaxu heretics must be removed before the great belief could resurface properly under Ajitika's firm guidance. He smiled as his thoughts raced through the myriad possibilities in his remarkable level of consciousness. Ajitika hardly slept at all anymore, and spent much of each day romping through his own marvelous mind, as if it were an amusement park of new experiences and delights. He could hold 97 simultaneous lines of thought in balance, ranging from mundane to complex subjects. He had the ability to study each mosaic of information as if it were a film book on a library shelf. Ajitamal was even better than Melange, even more intense. With it, guild navigators might be able to fold space into other universes, no longer restricted to one. One of his 97 balanced lines of thought moved to the forefront. By now, Count Fenring and Zoal would have substituted Ajitamal for Melange and at least 2 highliners, and the navigators should be about to use it. Fenring himself must be as dead as these victims here. The face dancer would have done his work well, and would return soon to report the details. With his imagined lizard eyes, the master researcher surveyed the sprawled, blotchy corpses. There could be no turning back from his holy mission now. His other face dancers would replace the old guard masters, and everything would appear normal. Then he could send them to Kaitain. From here, the face dancer replica of Master Zaf would send word to Bandalong that he had decided to remain on Xuta for several months, which was the amount of time Ajitika needed to complete his plans. Any others who got in the way would also be consumed, like insects caught on the tongue of a flying lizard. He imagined his tongue darting out, snapping up bugs and swallowing them. Darting and snapping, darting and snapping. He tasted their bitter, crunchy little bodies. The flying dragon hopped from the rafter and sailed slowly over the corpses, as if on an aerial inspection mission. With a blink of his eyes, Ajitika dragged his consciousness away from the lizard and returned to his own body, which stood in the doorway. His mouth had a bitter taste, and his tongue felt raw and sore. In an excited voice, he summoned his face dancers from the kitchen. They arrived promptly, ready for orders. "Dispose of the bodies, then prepare for a journey." As the shapeshifters set about their task, Ajitika searched for the little lizard. The elusive creature, however, was nowhere to be seen. With a thrill of amazement, a sunken-eyed Kater Pilru found the gruesome bodies at the disposal site. The hated invaders were not covered with enough garbage to conceal them fully. Slinking through shadows long after the strict curfew, Kater had arrived just as a ground truck departed, throwing rock dust into the air behind it. No one had seen him. He often frequented the subterranean dumping areas, searching for salvage items that he might adapt to his needs. But this? Dead Tleilaxu masters, more than 20 of them. High-ranking officials, every one. And they had been murdered. Their normally pallid skins were a scalded red color. He drew the only possible conclusion his weary mind could formulate. Here was proof that the resistance movement continued on Ix. Someone else is killing the Tleilaxu. Kater scratched his head, disarranging his ragged hair. He looked around in the low starlight from the projected sky, not certain what to do next. wondering who his mysterious allies were. Not long ago, a pair of Atreides men had promised that rescuers would arrive soon, like knights on white horses. In anticipation of this, other resistance groups must be mobilizing. He only hoped he lived long enough to see the glorious liberation of Ix. Romber was coming. At last! Not to be outdone, Kater went into darkened subterranean chambers in search of lone Tleilaxu. He had become hardened over the long, desperate years. By the end of the night, 7 more Tleilaxu joined the bodies at the disposal site. Any road followed precisely to its end leads precisely nowhere. You must climb the mountain just a little, enough to test that it's a mountain, enough to see where the other mountains are. From the top of any mountain, you cannot see that mountain. Empress Herade, consort to Crown Prince Raphael Corino. He had avoided this duty for half of his life, but now the departure could not come soon enough for Romber Vernius. He made no attempt to conceal his cyborg body. In light of his mission to Ix, he considered it a badge of honor. From Thufir Hawat's perfect memory, Dr. Yue made cosmetic modifications to disguise the sophisticated mechanical enhancements, making them look like primitive, clumsy devices. Romber hoped he could pass himself off as one of the part-human, part-machine monstrosities that Tleilaxu called Bi-Ixians. For weeks, Gurney and Romber had discussed strategy with the Duke and his highest-ranking military men. "The success or failure of this mission ultimately falls on my shoulders," Romber said, as he stood awaiting a shuttle that would take him and Gurney to the Highliner. "I'm not a kid collecting pretty rocks anymore. I need to remember everything my father ever taught me. By the age of 7, I had to memorize all the military codes, and I learned about every great battle House Vernius had ever fought. This struggle will be something for us to write songs about, something for your children to memorize," Gurney Halleck said with an encouraging smile. Then, from the way his expression stiffened, it was clear he regretted his remark. Breaking the uncomfortable silence, Romber said, "Yes, it will be something for all Ixians to tell their children and grandchildren." The necessary bribes had been paid. The Spacing Guild would again interfere with Tleilaxu defense scanners long enough for their camouflaged combat pod to slip into a hidden access port. This particular pod had been designed so that it could be dismantled for its parts, many of which had dual purposes as weapons themselves. The sleek, gray pod sat on struts in a loading dock, while Atreides' men hurried to make the link-ups that would connect it to the shuttle. Thufir and Duncan arrived to bid the two men farewell. Duke Leto had not appeared yet, and Romber refused to board the shuttle until he could embrace his friend. The liberation of Ix could not begin without an Atreides blessing. The night before, Romber had recharged his cyborg components, but his mind remained exhausted from lack of authentic sleep. His thoughts continued to press through questions. Tesha had worked her wonders, though, rubbing the tense muscles in the remaining flesh of his body, miraculously soothing him. Her dark brown eyes seemed full of pride and anticipation. "My love, my husband, I promise that our next night spent together will be in the Grand Palais." With a small chuckle, he said, "Not in my old rooms, though. You and I deserve more than a boyhood bedchamber." He gave a mighty heave of his chest and shoulders, simultaneously dreading and looking forward to seeing Ix again. The timetable was in place. Everything would adhere to a strict schedule because the separate prongs of the attack could not rely on communications while en route. There would be no room for error, or delay, or doubts. Duke Leto was counting on him and Gurney to soften up the Tlaloxu from within, to expose their underbelly, after which the Atreides military would deliver a hammer blow from the outside. Turning, he saw Leto. The Duke's black jacket was uncharacteristically wrinkled. The nobleman's chin and cheeks were shadowed with dark stubble. Poorly concealed behind his back, he held a large parcel gift-wrapped in gold paper with a ribbon on top. "You can't leave without this, Romber." Accepting the package, the prince determined from sensors in his arm that it was surprisingly light. "Leto, the combat pod is already so packed, there's barely enough room for Gurney and me." "You'll want to take this anyway." A rare smile broke through his normally hard expression. Fumbling to tear the wrapping paper with his mechanical fingers, Romber got it open. Inside the box he found a much smaller case. The hinged lid opened easily. "Vermilion hells!" The fire jewel ring was just like the one he had worn before the Skyclipper explosion, a ring that had represented his authority as the rightful Earl of House Vernius. "Fire jewels aren't easy to come by, Leto. Each stone has its own personality, its own unique appearance. Where did you get this? It looks just like the one I used to have. Of course, it couldn't be the same one." Leto's gray eyes twinkled as he draped a brotherly arm around the prince's artificial shoulders. "This is your ring, my friend, regenerated from a tiny fragment of the jewel that was found fused into the flesh of your hand." Romber's remaining organic eye blinked as if to drive back tears. This ring symbolized the glories of Ix, as well as the terrible losses he and his people had suffered. But his imaginary tears stopped, and his face hardened. He slipped the fire jewel ring onto the third finger of his prosthetic right hand. "Perfect fit." "And more good news," Duncan Idaho added. "According to the Spaceport Center, the Highliner on this route is the last Dominic-class vessel ever manufactured on Ix, newly refurbished from Junction. Sounds like a good omen to me." "Indeed, I will take it as that." Romber hugged each of his friends before heading for the private shuttle, accompanied by Gurney Halleck. Behind them, Leto, Duncan, and Thufir called out, "Victory on Ix!" To Romber's ears, it sounded like a statement of fact. He vowed to succeed, or die trying. We could be dreaming all the time, but we do not perceive those dreams while we are awake because consciousness, like the sun obscuring stars during the day, is much too brilliant to allow the unconscious content so much definition. Private Journals of Kwisatz Mother Anirul Sado Tonkin. Haunted from within her own mind, Lady Anirul could not sleep. Once roused, the voices of countless generations allowed her no rest. The intruders from other memory demanded her attention, begging her to look at historical precedents, insisting that their lives be remembered. Each one had something to say, a dire warning, a cry for attention, all of it inside her head. She wanted to scream. As the Emperor's consort, Anirul lived in greater luxury than the vast majority of the lives within her had ever experienced. She had access to servants, fine music, the most expensive drugs. Her combined chambers, filled with beautiful furniture, were large enough to encompass a small village. At one time, Anirul had thought being the Kwisatz mother had been a blessing. But the possession of her mind by a multitude from across the chasms of time was consuming too much of her as the moment of Jessica's delivery drew closer. The voices within knew that the end of the breeding program's long road was at last near. Restless on her oversized bed, Anirul flung the slippery sheets away. The fabric tangled and oozed to the floor as if it were a living invertebrate. Naked, Anirul walked to the gold inlay doors. Her skin was buttery and smooth, massaged daily with lotions and salves. A diet of melange recipes, as well as a few biochemical tweaks she accomplished internally using sisterhood training, kept her muscles toned and her body attractive, even if her husband no longer noticed her. In this room she had allowed Shaddam to impregnate her 5 times, but he rarely visited her bed anymore. The emperor had, quite correctly, given up hope that she would ever bear him a male heir. Now sterile, he would have no more children, not by her, nor by any of his concubines. Though her husband suspected she had taken other lovers during their years of marriage, Anirul required no personal entanglements to satisfy her needs. As a skilled Bene Gesserit, she had access to means of pleasuring herself with all the intensity she could desire. Now, what she desired most was a restful, deep sleep. She decided to go out into the quiet night. She would wander the huge palace, and maybe the capital city beyond, in the vain hope that her legs could carry her away from the voices. She grasped the door handles, then realized that she wore no clothes. In recent weeks, Anirul had overheard courtiers chattering about her unstable personality, rumors probably started by Shaddam himself. If she were to stride naked into the corridors, that would pour more fuel on the flames of gossip. Cinching a turquoise robe around herself, she tied an intricate knot that no one but a Bene Gesserit could release without a knife. Shoeless, she stepped onto the tile floor and headed from her rooms. She had often walked barefoot back at the mother school on Wallach 9. The chill climate provided a rigorous environment for young acolytes to learn endurance, to discover how to control their body heat, perspiration, and nerve responses. One time, Harishka, who was proctor superior of the school at the time, not yet mother superior, had led her young women into the snowy mountains, where she instructed all of them to remove every garment and trudge 4 kilometers through ice-encrusted snow to the top of a wind-swept peak. Once there, they had meditated for an hour in the nude, before climbing back down to their clothes and warmth. Anirul had nearly frozen to death that day, but the crisis had driven her to a better understanding of her metabolism and of her own mind. Even before putting her garments back on, she had made herself warm and comfortable, with no need of anything else. 4 of her acolyte classmates hadn't survived. Failures. And Harishka had left their bodies up in the snow, where they would remain as grim reminders for later students. Now, as Anirul wandered the palace corridors, ladies-in-waiting emerged from their rooms and rushed to her side. Not Jessica, though. She kept the pregnant young woman sheltered, protected, unaware of her personal turmoil.